Moderna has come under fire for both refusing to share its COVID vaccine tech as well as denying vaccines to poor countries in desperate need. Jimmy Kimmel said, "The COVID vaccine is Moderna's only product. It's the only thing the company sells. Imagine making only one thing and billions of people want it. This must be how the Baja men felt after recording Who Let the Dogs Out, you know? Trevor, look, man, I get it. Moderna's a business and they want to make money themselves, but at least come up with a better excuse, you know, like the vaccine formula is an old family recipe. Fallon, although it's been passed down from generation to generation, just like Mama used to make. Kimmel, the Times reported that Moderna has been supplying its shots almost exclusively to wealthy nations, keeping the poorer countries waiting and earning billions of dollars in profit. I'm sure that's just a coincidence, right? Guys, we're doing it alphabetically. America, Australia, Britain, Canada, Denmark. It's not our fault the rich countries come first. Zambia, Zimbabwe, we'll get there eventually. Hang in, Kimmel again. It's a shame that companies think about profit in a time like this when people are dying. But I get it. If they don't make money doing it this time, they might not bother to work on a vaccine next time. You know, every now and then when I'm prepping the show, I roll a 7. I was looking for a couple extra stories to finish out today's podcast, and I found 2 great ones that are so good that actually kicked some of the stories that were originally here. The Chicago Tribune caught up with Jeff Foxworthy, which means there's a good chance my half-assed Jeff Foxworthy impression busts out sometime during this article. We'll see. Jeff Foxworthy said, "I've been doing this for 37 years, and I think before last year, the longest I'd ever gone without being on stage is when I took 2 weeks off when each of my daughters was born. And then I took 1.5 years off. Yeah, I'm very happy. I still love what I do. It's never been like a job. I look around and go, keep your head down, your mouth shut. They're still letting you get away with it." Jeff said, "There's something about being a comedian that invites total strangers to open up to him. People will come up to you and tell you stuff they probably shouldn't tell their therapist. It's that inclusiveness. Every comedian is different. You find what works for you. Very early in my career, I decided if I think something or my wife says something or my family does something, I'm just going to assume that other people are thinking or saying or doing the same thing. I just trusted that. I have this thought. Surely other people are having this thought as well. So when I'm on stage, what I see people laugh and then they turn around and point to somebody on their row or they're elbowing their husband in the ribs. And I'm like, thank gosh, that's just my family. Other people are doing this too. That's what works. No matter what I'm playing, I always try to find the commonality. Even though we live in different places and we have different accents, what we do is the same. Much like his previous albums and comedy specials, the Good Old Days special is inspired by where he's at in life. Jeff said, my wife and I are at the stage where our kids are grown. We've got them raised and out of the house. We had a quick snack. And we started raising our parents. I swear they passed each other in the driveway. My father-in-law, probably like a lot of elderly people, doesn't like anything in the world. And he's always talking about how much better things were back in the good old days. Was it really better? Probably like anything else, some of it was better and some of it was much worse. I think about how everybody has a phone in their hand now. And I say, back in the good old days, my entire family had one phone. It was on the wall in the kitchen. My parents had sprung for the extra long cord. People that are older just start laughing because you remember that. That's the nostalgia. That makes a lot of people laugh. Jeff, you got me because I was thinking about the exact same thing, the long cord in my kitchen phone growing up. Yep. If you did any other job for 30 years, you'd know what works and what doesn't work. With comedy, you never know what the audience is going to laugh at. Even after 37 years, I don't know what they're going to laugh at. So early in COVID, I was writing like crazy, but I didn't have anywhere I could go try it out. After a few months, it became frustrating. I didn't know whether to keep developing it or not. I didn't know if it was something the audience was going to like or not. By early summer, there were some local clubs that were open, so I'd be down there on a Monday night with no cards in hand, trying the newer stuff I'd written. Imagine seeing Jeff Foxworthy in a club on a Monday night these days. That's amazing. It's funny, I've never been one of those people that gets nervous going on stage. This is what I do, but the first couple times back, I was nervous. Now I'm just enjoying it again. Jeff will tape a special for Netflix at the end of this month. He says, you guys are getting to see the stuff before it's a Netflix special. It's fun because there's so much new stuff. Hopefully it's fun for the audience too. Last summer, he hosted an auction show for A&E. It was called What It's Worth. Jeff said it was originally supposed to be a live show and then COVID hit. We figured out a way to do it virtually. I really enjoyed it, but they haven't talked about bringing it back. I guess if I enjoy it, that's the kiss of death. If I had hated doing it, they would have wanted 200 episodes. What we found on the show was that people kept wrapped up that they thought was worth something was almost always worth nothing. And the thing they had not taken care of was worth $500,000. Although he's mostly known for his "you might be a redneck" jokes, he says he's mostly retired that portion of the act from his show. The thing about them is they're one-liners. They're easy to remember, easy to retell. That's what made them so popular. Comedy's a little different from music. I tell my musician friends, if you write 4 hits, you're going to play till you're 90 because people want to come hear those 4 songs. Whereas with jokes, once you do an album or special, people are like, I've already heard that. What do you got that's new? As a comic, you're always trying to generate new stuff. For me, it was like, I want to talk about something else now. I can always whip a few out if people want them. He did the first You Might Be a Redneck calendar in 1990. He's working on the calendar for 2023 now. And he said, every year I'm like, there can't be 365 more. And there always are. Looking back at COVID, I don't think laughter makes the struggle go away, but it's kind of the release valve that keeps the boiler from exploding. Laughter and live music. You think about it, for the last year and a half, most of us went through one of the most challenging things many of us will ever go through. And the two things we haven't had are comedy and live music. So what I'm finding at the end of the night, people are coming up to me and saying, I remember the last time I laughed like that, just laugh for an hour and a half. People need that. There's something in the human spirit. It helps us refortify ourselves and help us deal with whatever we've got to deal with. It's changed the way I look at what I do. It's something we need. If you are a regular listener, you've heard me talk in the past about Jeff Foxworthy, the nicest man you will ever meet. And from the Ottumwa Courier, your home for comedy news, Jeff Foxworthy's former tour mates Ron White is also back out on the road. He knew he had to start stretching out again. He went back to Florida where his mom lives and was the only place that was open. He started doing 25-minute walk-on shows in comedy clubs. I built up until I could do about 45 minutes with power and started doing headline shows in comedy clubs, which is something he hadn't done in 20 years. I did that until I was ready for bigger dates and longer sets. It's all back and running. All the things I was really good at, pacing and such, I took for granted because I did it every day. I did it so much I didn't know you had to practice, but I did the work. For the first time, I gave myself credit for how good I was. Ron talked about how his stage props have evolved over the years. He originally started with a beer and a cigarette. Then he switched to the cigar and whiskey, and you've seen Amy Schumer make fun of that on her album cover. And for the last 8 years, he's changed over to tequila. He said that change was the recommendation of his doctor. Ron White said, Scotch will beat you up on the inside. Tequila is just better for you than Scotch is. If you're going to drink, drink tequila. But he said, even with the Scotch, it was always top shelf with no mixers. But really, it's more about what they provide to the atmosphere of the show. He said, there's signs of alcoholism and bad behavior. I guess it's a reason not to be talking. It's a great pause to take a drag off a cigar or a drink. There's nothing better for a great comedy than a great pause or misdirection. And he said, early in his career, he didn't know what to do with his hands, and the props solved the problem. Ron was asked why he thought audiences related to his comedy. He said, it's a question I ask all the time. I don't know why they feel that connection to it. I've had a run that most comics could only dream of for 20 years. They love me for some reason. I don't really know why. I think I kind of let them know who I really am. Maybe they could tell that I love them. I can make them laugh really hard. I guess that's it. They like to laugh as hard as they can. I try to go on stage and make them hurt from laughing because that's the kind of joy they're after. He says he does not do political issues in his stand-up. It's not what they need from me. What they need from me is to laugh. There's a lot of tension in the country right now. During the last two elections, I never once mentioned politics. That's not my job. It has never been. I've been around Ron a few times, twice, three times backstage. It was exactly what you thought it would be, and I'll leave it at that. The Guardian had a very long but very good interview with Tim Minchin. Tim spoke about quitting comedy, and he said, there's a reason why famous people are often screwed up. In 2003, I booked a tiny venue for Melbourne Fringe Festival to perform a show I had tortuously titled Naval, Cerebral Melodies with Umbilical Cords. It was a sort of dark, ridiculous cabaret and a desperate attempt to shake off the pain of all the rejections I've been getting from agents, record companies, the dude who approved small loans at the bank, by showcasing my various talents, which arguably included unusually clear diction, considerable manual dexterity, and a love of cheap double entendre, which is to say there were some outstanding jokes about fingering. Naval was a game changer for me because I knew I had an unusual toolkit, and although I knew I had a tendency to play the clown, I didn't by any stretch think of myself as a comedian, but that night everything changed. The 30-odd weirdos perched on bar stools and chaise lounges laughed a lot. 7 short years later, I was playing arenas. I saw Tim for the first time sometime between the barstool day and the arena day. I saw him, I guess it was a Chicago Comedy Festival for the first time. I remember it was a bar, and I was in the upper deck, and this guy comes out, and he looks like a rock star, and he can sing, and he can play piano, and he's theatrical, and the songs were hilarious. We were blown away by Tim Minchin when we saw him that night. Tim said, my 2010 tour involved a 55-piece symphony orchestra and dozens of crew, grand pianos and scissor lifts, massive light shows, tour buses, bouncers, booths, fans with my lyrics or my face tattooed on their legs. My silliest dreams. I never imagined a life like it. The shows were joyous and complex and fun and challenging. The rewards were huge. I was flying, so I stopped. And barring a couple of spasms of activism, I haven't written a comedy song in more than 10 years. Wow, I didn't realize it's been 10 years. The reasons I stopped are not particularly dramatic. There was no big crisis or breakdown. No moment of realization that I'd been suckling on the teat of the devil. The reason I stopped was temperance, or so I like to claim. And honest, it was also an ambition, but we'll get to that. I wanted to not become an unbearable tool with a huge, tiny ego. By temperance, I mean that I saw dangers ahead. I'm married to my childhood sweetheart, Sarah, and we had kids relatively young. I like my kids and I like Sarah. I like peace and quiet. I love running and eating reasonably. I like playing piano by myself, and I like being able to walk to the shops without being stopped. I like my liver, but you know what else I like? Like I really effing like? I really like wine. I really like tour buses with cheese platters at midnight, nice hotels, and someone to sort my washing. I like 10,000 people leaping to their feet to applaud me. I like heads turning when I walk in a bar and being stopped in boots for photos. I like hanging out with smart, funny people and getting papped on the way out of the grouch show. I like being respected by people I admire. I like ending up in late night bars in romantic cities and having the shock of realization that a sexy person is hitting on me. I, like everyone, love feeling wanted, and I knew that none of that crap is good for a person. In short, I wanted to head hedonism off at the pass, I wanted to not become an alcoholic, I wanted to not cheat on my partner, and I wanted to not become an unbearable tool with a huge tiny ego. But I also stopped doing comedy because I'm very ambitious. My ambition is not for wealth, although that's another trap I can clang warning bells about. And it's not for fame, although it's an addiction that once tasted and most never quite shake. And it's probably not for power, although some is useful to an artist. My ambition is immodest and obtuse, I want to be unpigeonholable. I wrote scores for kids' theater companies. I did improv. I had a 70s cover band. My brother and I recorded an album in our house share. I produced soundtracks for friends' documentaries and short films. I wrote songs for co-op musicals, rigged lights and built sets, played piano in red dirt mining towns, played the eponymous whiner in a three-hander Hamlet. All through my 20s, I was jack of all trades, master of making no money. Then everything went bang and suddenly I was an effing comedian. Continuing from The Guardian, but holy cow, have I missed touring. Once you felt that buzz of having a live audience on string, the pure unfettered joy of a group of musicians gelling perfectly, the relief of having got away with it again, you never forget it. So I decided to come back with a show called Back, as if I'd forgotten the reason I accidentally became comedian in the first place. When I'm on stage, I feel compelled to go for the laugh. So within a week of getting back on the road, it started to resemble what I now realize is simply my thing, a ridiculous dark cabaret show. Now almost 20 years in the making. Tim Minchin's Back is touring the UK now through the November 28th. You can also go see Matilda the Musical at the Cambridge Theatre in London. And that is your comedy news for today. A new episode of the weekly comedy thing on the Live by Live app. What's that? That is a show where I talk a lot less and play a lot more comedy. So the Tim Minchin story I just told you for about 7 minutes, I would tell the 30-second version of that and then play Tim Minchin. That's how that goes. It's called The Weekly Comedy Thing on Live by Live. The app is free. The show is free. Check that out. This show, if you don't already, please follow on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. Tell a friend about it. Instagram is @Daily Comedy News. The Facebook group is Daily Comedy News Podcast. Meet you back here tomorrow.